Delanor had never heard anything so philosophical from the Stormfather. He hadn't imagined it was possible that a Spren, even a mighty one of the High Storms, could dream in such a way. Delanor found himself hurtling through the air. Flailing his arms, he shouted in panic. First Moon's violet light bathed the ground far below. His stomach lurched, and his clothes flapped in the wind. He continued yelling until he realized that he wasn't actually getting closer to the ground. He wasn't falling. He was flying. The air was rushing against the top of his head, not his face. Indeed, now he saw that his body was glowing, stormlight streaming off him. He didn't feel like he was holding it, though. No raging inside his veins, no urge to action. He shielded his face from the wind and looked forward. A Radiant flew ahead, resplendent in blue armor that glowed, the light brightest at the edges and in the grooves. The man was looking back at Delanor, doubtless because of his cries. Delanor saluted him to indicate he was all right. The armored man nodded, looking forward again. "He's a Windrunner," Delanor thought, piecing it together. "I've taken the place of his companion, a female Radiant." He'd seen these two in the vision before. They were flying to save the village. Delanor wasn't moving under his own power. The Windrunner had lashed the female Radiant into the sky, as Zeth had done to Delanor during the Battle of Narak. It was still difficult to accept that he wasn't falling, and a sinking feeling persisted in the pit of his stomach. He tried to focus on other things. He was wearing an unfamiliar brown uniform, though he was glad to note that he had his side sword as requested. But why didn't he have on shard plate? In the vision, the woman had worn a set that glowed amber. Was this the result of the Stormfather trying to make him look like himself to Fen? Delanor still didn't know why Radiant plate glowed, while modern shard plate did not. Was the ancient plate living somehow, like Radiant blades lived? Perhaps he could find out from that Radiant ahead. He had to ask his questions carefully, however. Everyone would see Delanor as the Radiant he had replaced, and if his questions were uncharacteristic, that tended only to confuse people, rather than get him answers. "How far away are we?" Delanor asked. The sound was lost in the wind, so he shouted it more loudly, drawing the attention of his companion. "Not long now," the man shouted back, voice echoing inside his helm, which glowed blue, most strongly at the edges and across the eye slit. "I think something might be wrong with my armor," Delanor shouted to him. "I can't make my helm retract." In response, the other Radiant made his vanish. Delanor caught sight of a puff of light or mist. Beneath the helm, the man had dark skin and curly black hair. His eyes glowed blue.
"Retract your helm?" he shouted. "You haven't summoned your armor yet. You had to dismiss it so I could lash you."
"Oh," Delanor thought.
"I mean earlier. It wouldn't vanish when I wanted it to." "Talk to Har Kaelain, then. Or to your Spren."
The Windrunner frowned.
"Will this be a problem for our mission?"
"I don't know," Delanor shouted. "But it distracted me. Tell me again how we know where to go, and what we know of the things we're going to fight."
He winced at how awkward that sounded.
"Just be ready to back me up against the Midnight Essence and use regrowth on any wounded."
"But..."
"You will find difficulty getting useful answers, Son of Honor," the Stormfather rumbled. "These do not have souls or minds. They are recreations forged by Honor's will, and do not have the memories of the real people."
"Surely we can learn things," Delanor said under his breath.
"They were created to convey only certain ideas. Further pressing will merely reveal the thinness of the facade."
This brought up memories of the fake city Delanor had visited in his first vision, the destroyed version of Kolinar that was more prop than reality. But there had to be things he could learn, things that Honor might not have intended but had included by chance.
"I need to get Navani and Yasna in here," he thought. "Let them pick at these recreations."
Last time in this vision, Dalinar had taken the place of a man named Heb, a husband and father who had defended his family with only a fireplace poker for a weapon. He remembered his frantic struggle with a beast of oily midnight skin. He had fought, bled, agonized. He'd spent what seemed like an eternity trying and eventually failing to protect his wife and daughter. Such a personal memory. False though it was, he had lived it. In fact, seeing the small town ahead, in the lake created by a large ridge of rock, made emotions well up inside Dalinar. It was a painful irony that he should have such vivid feelings about this place, these people, when his memories of Evie were still so shadowy and confused. The Windrunner slowed Dalinar by grabbing his arm. They drew to a stop in midair, hovering above the rocky flats outside the village.
There!
The Windrunner pointed to the field around the town, where weird black creatures were swarming. About the size of an axe hound, they had oily skin that reflected the moonlight. While they moved on all sixes, they were like no natural animal. They had spindly legs like a crab's, but a bulbous body and a sinuous head, featureless except for a slit of a mouth bristling with black teeth. Shallan had faced the source of these things deep within Urethiru. Dalinar had slept a little less secure each night since, knowing that one of the unmade had been hidden in the bowels of the tower. Were the other eight similarly lurking nearby?
"I'll go down first," the Windrunner said, "and draw their attention. You make for the town and help the people there."
The man pressed his hand against Dalinar.
"You'll drop in about 30 seconds.
The man's helm materialized, then he plunged toward the monsters. Dalinar remembered that descent from the vision, like a falling star come to rescue Dalinar and the family.
"How?" Dalinar whispered to the Stormfather. "How do we get the armor?"
"Speak the words."
"Which words?"
"You will know or you will not."
"Great." Dalinar saw no sign of Taffa or Seeley, the family he'd protected, below. In his version, they'd been out here, but their flight had been his doing. He couldn't be sure how the vision had played out this time. Storms. He hadn't planned this very well, had he? In his mind's eye, he'd anticipated getting to Queen Fen and helping her along, making sure she wasn't in too much danger. Instead, he'd wasted time flying here.
Stupid.
He needed to learn to be more specific with the Stormfather. Dalinar began to descend in a controlled float. He had some idea of how the Windrunner's surges worked together, but he was impressed nonetheless. Just as he touched down, the feeling of lightness left him and the stormlight rising from his skin puffed away. This left him as much less of a target in the darkness than the other Radiant, who glowed like a brilliant blue beacon, sweeping about himself with a grand shard blade as he fought the Midnight Essence. Dalinar crept through the town, his common side sword feeling frail compared to a shard blade, but at least it wasn't an iron poker. Some of the creatures scrambled by on the main thoroughfare, but Dalinar hid beside a boulder until they passed. He easily identified the proper house, which had a small barn out back, nestled against the stone cliff that sheltered the town. He crept up and found that the barn wall had been ripped open. He remembered hiding in there with Seeley, then fleeing as a monster attacked. The barn was empty, so he headed for the house, which was much finer. Made of creme bricks and larger, though it seemed only one family lived in it. For a house this big, that would be an oddity, wouldn't it? Space was at a premium in Lates. Some of his assumptions obviously didn't hold in this era. In Alethkar, a fine wooden mansion would be a symbol of wealth. Here, however, many of the other houses were of wood. Dalinar slipped into the house, feeling increasingly worried. Fen's real body couldn't be harmed by what happened in the vision, but she could still feel pain. So while the injuries might not be real, her anger at Dalinar certainly would be. He could ruin any chance of her listening to him.
"She's already given up on listening," he assured himself.
Navani agreed. This vision couldn't make things worse. He felt in his uniform's pocket and was pleased to find some gemstones. A radiant would have stormlight. He took out a small diamond, the size of a pebble, and used its white light to inspect the room. The table had been overturned, chairs scattered. The door hung open and creaked softly in a breeze. There was no sign of Queen Fen, but Taffa's body lay face down near the hearth. She wore a single-piece brown dress, now in tatters. Dalinar sighed, sheathing his sword and kneeling to gently touch her back in a spot unraked by monster claws.
"It's not real," he told himself. "Not now. This woman lived and died thousands of years ago."
It still hurt to see her. He walked to the swinging door and stepped outside into the night, where howls and cries rang out from the town. He strode quickly down the roadway, feeling a sense of urgency. No, not just urgency, impatience. Seeing Taffa's corpse had changed something. He was not a confused man trapped in a nightmare, as he'd feared when first visiting this place. Why was he sneaking? These visions belonged to him. He should not fear their contents. One of the creatures scuttled out of the shadows. Dalinar drew in stormlight as it leaped and bit at his leg. Pain flared up his side, but he ignored it, and the wound re-knit. He glanced down as the creature lunged again, with similar lack of results. It scurried backward a few paces, and he could sense confusion in its posture. This was not how its prey was supposed to act.
"You don't eat the corpses," Dalinar said to it. "You kill for pleasure, don't you? I often think of how Spren and man are so different, but this we share. We can both murder."
The unholy thing came at him again, and Dalinar seized it in both hands. The body felt springy to the touch, like a wineskin filled to bursting. He painted the writhing monster with stormlight and spun, hurling it toward a nearby building. The creature hit the wall back first and stuck there several feet above the ground, legs scrambling. Dalinar continued on his way. He simply cut through the next two creatures that came for him. Their disjointed bodies twitched, black smoke leaking from the carcasses.
"What is that light?"
It danced in the night ahead, growing stronger, harsh, orange, flooding the end of the street. He didn't remember a fire from before. Were homes burning? Dalinar approached and found a bonfire, flickering with flame spren, built of furniture. It was surrounded by dozens of people holding brooms and crude picks, men and women alike, armed with whatever they could find, even an iron poker or two. Judging by the fear spren gathered around them, the townspeople were terrified. They managed some semblance of ranks anyway, with children at the center, nearer the fires, as they frantically defended themselves from the midnight monsters. A figure near the fire commanded from the top of a box. Fen's voice had no accent. To Dalinar, her shouts seemed to be in perfect Alethi, though, in the strange way of these visions, everyone present was actually speaking and thinking in an ancient language.
"How did she manage this so quickly?" Dalinar wondered, mesmerized by the fighting townsfolk.
Some of them fell in bloody screaming heaps, but others pinned down the monsters and stabbed open their backs, sometimes with kitchen knives, to deflate them. Dalinar remained on the outskirts of the battle until a dramatic figure in glowing blue swept down upon the scene. The Windrunner made short work of the remaining creatures. At the end, he saved a glare for Dalinar.
"What are you doing standing there? Why haven't you helped?"
"I... We'll have words about this when we return," he shouted, pointing toward one of the fallen.
"Go! Help the wounded!"
Dalinar followed the gesture, but walked toward Fen instead of the wounded. Some of the townspeople huddled and wept, though others exulted in survival, cheering and holding up their improvised weapons. He'd seen these after-effects of a battle before. The welling up of emotions came in a variety of ways. The bonfire's heat caused Dalinar's brow to sweat. Smoke churned in the air, reminding him of the place he'd been before he'd fully entered this vision. He'd always loved the warmth of an actual fire, dancing with flame-spren, so eager to burn themselves out and die. Ben was over a foot shorter than Dalinar, with an oval face, yellow eyes, and white Thalen eyebrows she kept curled to hang down beside her cheeks. She did not braid her gray hair like an Alethi woman would have, but instead let it fall down to cover her shoulders. The vision had given her a simple shirt and trousers to wear, the costume of the man she'd replaced, though she'd found a glove for her safe hand.
"Now the Blackthorn himself shows up," she said. "Damnation, this is a strange dream."
"Not quite a dream, Fen," Dalinar said, looking back toward the Radiant, who had charged a small group of midnight monsters coming down the street. "I don't know if I have time to explain."
"I can slow it down," one of the villagers said in the Stormfather's voice.
"Yes, please," Dalinar said.
Everything stopped, or slowed greatly. The bonfire's flames shimmered lethargically, and the people slowed to a crawl. Dalinar was unaffected, as was Fen. He sat down on a box beside the one Fen stood on, and she hesitantly settled down next to him.
"A very strange dream."
"I assumed I was dreaming myself when I saw the first vision," Dalinar said. "When they kept happening, I was forced to acknowledge that no dream is this crisp, this logical. In no dream could we be having this conversation."
"In every dream I've experienced, what happened felt natural at the time."
"Then you will know the difference when you wake. I can show many more of these visions to you, Fen. They were left for us by a being with some interest in helping us survive the desolations.
Best not to get into his heresy at the moment."
"If one isn't persuasive enough, I understand. I'm dense enough that I didn't trust them for months."
"Are they all this invigorating?"
Dalinar smiled.
"This was the most powerful of them, to me."
He looked to her.
"You did better than I did. I worried only about Taffa and her daughter, but just ended up getting them surrounded by monsters anyway."
"I let the woman die," Fen said softly. "I ran with the child and let the thing kill her. Used her almost as bait."
She looked at Dalinar, eyes haunted.
"What was your purpose in this, Kolin? You imply you have power over these visions. Why did you trap me in this one?"
"Honestly, I just wanted to talk to you."
"Send me a storming letter."
"In person, Fen."
He nodded toward the gathered townspeople.
"You did this. You organized the town, pitted them against the enemy. It's remarkable. You expect me to accept that you will turn your back on the world in a similar moment of need?"
"Don't be dense. My kingdom is suffering. I'm seeing to my people's needs. I'm not turning my back on anyone."
Dalinar looked to her and pursed his lips, but said nothing.
"Fine," she snapped. "Fine, Kolin. You want to dig into it for real? Tell me this. You really expect me to believe that the Storming Knights Radiant are back, and that the Almighty chose you, a tyrant and a murderer, to lead them?"
In response, Dalinar stood up and drew in stormlight. His skin began glowing with luminescent smoke drifting from his body.
"If you wish proof, I can persuade you. Incredible though it seems, the Radiants have returned."
"And the second part? Yes, there is a new storm and perhaps new manifestations of power. Fine. What I don't accept is that you, Dalinar Kolin, have been told by the Almighty to lead us."
"I have been commanded to unite."
"A mandate from God. The very same argument the Hierocracy used for seizing control of the government. What about Sadies, the Sunmaker? He claimed he had a calling from the Almighty, too."
She stood and walked among the people of the town, who stood as if frozen, barely moving. She turned and swept a hand back toward Dalinar.
Now here you are, saying the same things in the same way. Not quite threats, but insistent. Let us join forces. If we don't, the world is doomed.
Dalinar felt his patience slipping. He clenched his jaw, forced himself to be calm, and rose.
Your Majesty, you're being irrational.
Am I? Oh, let me storming reconsider, then. All I need to do is let the storming Blackthorn himself into my city, so he can take control of my armies.
What would you have me do?
Dalinar shouted.
Would you have me watch the world crumble?
She cocked her head at his outburst.
Maybe you're right, and I am a tyrant. Maybe letting my armies into your city is a terrible risk. But maybe you don't have good options. Maybe all the good men are dead, so all you have is me. Spitting into the storm isn't going to change that, Fen. You can risk possibly being conquered by the Alethi, or you can definitely fall to the Voidbringer assault alone.
Curiously, Fen crossed her arms and raised her left hand to her chin, inspecting Dalinar. She didn't seem the least bit fazed by his shouting. Dalinar stepped past a squat man who was slowly, as if through tar, turning toward where they'd once been seated.
Fen, Dalinar said, you don't like me. Fine. You tell me to my face that trusting me is worse than a desolation.
She studied him, aged eyes thoughtful. What was wrong? What had he said?
Fen, he tried again, I...
Where was this passion earlier? She asked. Why didn't you speak like this in your letters to me?
I... Fen, I was being diplomatic.
She sniffed.
That made it sound like I was talking to a committee. It's what one always assumes anyway when communicating via Spanreed.
So?
So compared to that, it's good to hear some honest shouting.
She eyed the people standing around them.
And this is exceptionally creepy. Can we get away from this?
Dalinar found himself nodding, mostly to buy some time to think.
Fen seemed to think his anger was a good thing.
He gestured at a path through the crowd, and Fen joined him, walking away from the bonfire.
Fen, he said, you say you expected to talk to a committee through the Spanreed. What's wrong with that? Why would you want me to shout at you instead?
I don't want you to shout at me, Colin, she said. But storms, man. Don't you know what has been said about you these last few months?
No.
You've been the hottest topic on the Spanreed informant networks. Dalinar Colin, the Blackthorn, has gone mad. He claims to have killed the Almighty. One day he refuses to fight, then the next day he marches his armies off on an insane quest into the Shattered Plains. He says he's going to enslave the Voidbringers.
I didn't say...
Nobody expects every report to be true, Dalinar. But I had extremely good information claiming you'd lost your mind. Refounding the Knights Radiant? Raving about a desolation? You seized the throne of Alethkar in all but title, but refused to fight the other high princes, and instead ran your armies off into the Weeping. Then you told everyone a new storm was coming. That was enough to convince me that you really were mad.
But then the storm came, Dalinar said.
But then the storm came.
The two walked down the quiet street, light from behind flooding across them, making their shadows lengthen. To their right, a calm blue light shone between buildings, the Radiant, who fought monsters in slowed time. Yasna could probably learn something from these buildings with their old architecture. These people wearing unfamiliar clothing. He'd have expected everything in the past to be crude, but it wasn't. The doors, the buildings, the clothing. It was well made, just lacking something he couldn't define.
The Everstorm proved I wasn't mad? Dalinar asked.
It proved that something was happening.
Dalinar suddenly stopped.
You think I'm working with them? You think that explains my behavior, my foreknowledge? You think I've been acting erratically because I've been in contact with the Voidbringers?
All I knew, Fenn said, was that the voice on the other end of the span reed was not the Dalinar Kho-Lin I'd expected. The words were too polite, too calm to be trusted.
And now? Dalinar asked.
Fenn turned. Now, I'll consider. Can I see the rest of it? I want to know what happens to the little girl.
Dalinar followed her gaze and saw, for the first time, little Seeley sitting, huddled with some other children near the fire. She had a haunted cast to her eyes. He could imagine her horror as Fenn ran away, Taffa, the child's mother, screaming as she was ripped apart.
Seeley suddenly lurched into motion, turning her head to stare with a hollow gaze at a woman who knelt beside her, offering something to drink. The Stormfather had restored the vision's normal speed. Dalinar backed up, letting Fenn rejoin the people and experience the end of the vision. As he folded his arms to watch, he noted a shimmering in the air beside him.
"We'll want to send her more of these," Dalinar said to the Stormfather. "We can only be served by more people knowing the truths the Almighty left behind. Can you bring in only one person per storm, or can we accelerate that somehow? And can you bring two people into two different visions at once?"
The Stormfather rumbled.
"I do not like to be ordered about."
"And you prefer the alternative? Letting Odium win? How far will your pride push you, Stormfather?"
"It is not pride," the Stormfather said, sounding stubborn. "I am not a man. I do not bend or cower. I do what is in my nature, and to defy that is pain."
The Radiant finished off the last of the midnight creatures and stepped up to the gathered people, then looked at Fenn.
"Your upbringing might be humble, but your talent for leadership is impressive. I have rarely seen a man, king or commander, organize people for defense as well as you did here today."
Fenn cocked her head.
"No words for me, I see," the knight said. "Very well. But should you wish to learn true leadership, come to Urethiru."
Dalinar turned to the Stormfather.
"That's almost exactly what the knight said to me last time."
"By design, certain things always happen in the visions," the Stormfather replied. "I do not know Honor's every intention, but I know he wished you to interact with Radiance and know that men could join them."
"All who resist are needed," the Radiant said to Fenn. "Indeed, any who have a desire to fight should be compelled to come to Alethala. We can teach you, help you. If you have the soul of a warrior, that passion could destroy you unless you are guided. Come to us."
The Radiant strode off, then Fenn jumped as Seeley stood up and started talking to her. The girl's voice was too quiet for Dalinar to hear, but he could guess what was happening. At the end of each vision, the Almighty himself spoke through one of the people, passing along wisdom that, at first, Dalinar had assumed was interactive. Fenn seemed troubled by what she heard. As well she should be. Dalinar remembered the words. "This is important," the Almighty had said. "Do not let strife consume you. Be strong. Act with honor, and honor will aid you." Except honor was dead. At the end of it, Fenn turned toward Dalinar, her eyes measuring.
"She still does not trust you," the Stormfather said.
"She wonders if I created this vision with the power of the Voidbringers. She no longer thinks I'm mad, but she does continue to wonder if I've joined the enemy."
"So you've failed again."
"No," Dalinar said. "Tonight she listened, and I think she'll end up taking the gamble of coming to Urethiru."
The Stormfather rumbled, sounding confused.
Why?
Because, Dalinar said, I know how to talk to her now. She doesn't want polite words or diplomatic phrases. She wants me to be myself. I'm fairly certain that's something I can deliver. 35. First into the sky. You think yourself so clever, but my eyes are not those of some petty noble to be clouded by a false nose and some dirt on the cheeks. Someone bumped Sigzil's cot, waking him from a dream. He yawned, and Rock's breakfast bell began ringing in the next room. He'd been dreaming in Azish. He'd been back home studying for the governmental service tests. Passing would have qualified him to enter a real school with a shot at becoming a clerk to someone important. Only in the dream, he'd been panicked to realize he'd forgotten how to read. After so many years away, thinking of his mother tongue felt strange. He yawned again, settling on his cot, back to the stone wall. They had three small barracks and a common room in the center. Out there, everyone pushed, ramble-scramble, up to the breakfast table. Rock had to shout at them, yet again, to organize themselves. Months in Bridge 4, now apprentice Knights Radiant, and a lot of them still couldn't figure out how to line up properly. They wouldn't last a day in Aesir, where queuing in an orderly way wasn't only expected, it was practically a mark of national pride. Sigzil rested his head against the wall, remembering. He'd been the first from his family in generations with a real shot at passing the exams. A silly dream. Everyone in Aesir talked about how even the humblest man could become prime, but the son of a laborer had so little time to study. He shook his head, then washed with a basin of water he'd fetched the night before. He took a comb to his hair and inspected himself in a polished length of steel. His hair was growing far too long. The tight black curls had a tendency to stick straight out. He set out a sphere to use its light for a shave. He had acquired his own razor. Soon after he started, however, he nicked himself. He sucked in a breath at the pain, and his sphere winked out. What? His skin started glowing, letting off a faint luminescent smoke. Oh, right. Kaladin was back. Well, that was going to solve so many problems. He got out another sphere and did his best not to eat this one as he finished shaving. Afterward, he pressed his hand against his forehead. Once, he'd had slave brands there. The stormlight had healed those, though his Bridge 4 tattoo remained. He rose and put on his uniform. Colin blue, sharp and neat. He slid his new hogshide notebook into his pocket, then stepped out into the common room, and stopped short as Lopin's face swung down right in front of him. Sigzil almost slammed into the Herdazian, who was stuck by the bottoms of his feet to the storming ceiling. "Hey!" Lopin said, bowl of morning porridge held upside down, or, well, right side up, but upside down to Lopin, in front of him. The Herdazian tried to take a bite, but the porridge slipped off his spoon and splatted to the ground.
"Lopin, what are you doing?"
"Practicing. I've got to show them how good I am, Hooch. It's like with women, only it involves sticking yourself to the ceiling and learning not to spill food on the heads of people you like."
"Move, Lopin."
"Ah, you have to ask the right way. I'm not one-armed anymore. I can't be shoved around. Say, do you know how to get two-armed Herdazians to do what you want?"
"If I did, we wouldn't be having this conversation."
"Well, you take away both of their spears, obviously."
He grinned. A few feet away, Rock laughed with a loud,
"Huh."
Lopin wiggled his fingers at Sigzil, as if to taunt him, fingernails glistening. Like all Herdazians, he had fingernails that were dark brown and hard as crystal, a bit reminiscent of carapace. He still had a tattoo on his head, too. Though so far only a few of Bridge 4 had learned to draw in stormlight, each of those had kept their tattoos. Only Kaladin was different. His tattoo had melted off once he took in stormlight, and his scars refused to heal.
"Remember that one for me, Hooch,"
Lopin said. He never would explain what Hooch meant, or why he used it only to refer to Sigsel.
"I'll need sure lots and lots of new jokes. Also sleeves. Twice as many of those, except on vests. Then the same number."
"How did you even manage to get up there? So you could stick your feet..."
"No. Don't start. I don't actually want to know."
Sigsel ducked under Lopin. The men were still scrambling for food, laughing and shouting in complete disarray. Sigsel shouted to get their attention.
"Don't forget! The captain wanted us up and ready for inspection by second bell."
Sigsel could barely be heard. Where was Teft? They actually listened when he gave orders. Sigsel shook his head, weaving his way toward the door. Among his people, he was of average height. But he'd gone and moved among the Alethi, who were practically giants. So here, he was a few inches shorter than most. He slipped out into the hallway. The bridge crews occupied a sequence of large barracks on the tower's first floor. Bridge 4 were gaining radiant powers, but there were hundreds more men in the battalion who were still ordinary infantry. Perhaps Teft had gone to inspect the other crews. He'd been given responsibility for training them. Hopefully it wasn't the other thing. Kaladin bunked in his own small suite of rooms at the end of the hallway. Sigsel made his way there, going over his scribbles in the notebook. He used Alethi glyphs, as was acceptable for a man out here, and had never learned their actual writing system. Storms, he'd been away so long, the dream was probably right. He might have trouble writing in the Azish script. What would life be like if he hadn't turned into a failure and a disappointment? If he'd passed the tests instead of getting into trouble, needing to be rescued by the man who had become his master? "The list of problems first," he decided, reaching Kaladin's door and knocking.
"Come,"
the captain's voice said from inside. Sigsel found Kaladin doing morning push-ups on the stone floor. His blue jacket was draped over a chair.
"Sir,"
Sigsel said.
"Hey, Sig,"
Kaladin said, grunting as he continued his push-ups.
"Are the men up and mustered?"
"Up, yes," Sigsel said. "When I left them, they seemed bordering on a food fight, and only half were in uniform."
"They'll be ready," Kaladin said. "Was there something you wanted, Sig?"
Sigsel settled down in the chair next to Kaladin's coat and opened his notebook.
"A lot of things, sir. Not the least of which is the fact that you should have a real scribe, not... whatever I am."
"You're my clerk."
"A poor one. We have a full battalion of fighting men with only 3 lieutenants and no official scribes. Frankly, sir, the bridge crews are a mess. Our finances are in shambles, requisition orders are piling up faster than Leighton can deal with them, and there's an entire host of problems requiring an officer's attention."
Kaladin grunted.
"The fun part of running an army."
"Exactly."
"That was sarcasm, Sig." Kaladin stood up and wiped his brow with a towel.
"All right, go ahead."
"We'll start with something easy," Sigsel said. "Pete is now officially betrothed to the woman he's been seeing."
"Ka? That's wonderful. Maybe she could help you with scribe duties."
"Perhaps. I believe that you were looking into requisitioning housing for men with families."
"Yeah, that was before the whole mess with the Weeping and the expedition onto the Shattered Plains, and I should go back to Dalinar's scribes about it, shouldn't I?"
"Unless you expect the married couples to share a bunk in the standard barracks, then I'd say that yes, you should."
Sigsel looked to the next page in his book.
"I believe Bissig is close to being betrothed as well."
"Really? He's so quiet. I never know what's going on behind those eyes of his."
"Not to mention Punio, who I found out recently is already married. His wife drops off food for him."
"I thought that was his sister."
"He wanted to fit in, I believe," Sigsel said. "His broken Alethi already makes that hard. And then there's the matter of Drahi."
"What matter?"
"Well, he's been courting a man, you see."
Kaladin threw on his coat, chuckling.
"I did know about that one. You only now noticed?"
Sigsel nodded.
"It's Drew he's been seeing still, from the district quartermaster's offices?"
"Yes, sir."
Sigsel looked down.
Sir, I... Well, it's just that...
Yes?
Sir, Drahi hasn't filled out the proper forms,
Sigsel said.
If he wants to court another man, he needs to apply for social reassignment, right?
Kaladin rolled his eyes. So, there were no forms for that in Alethkar. Sigsel couldn't say he was surprised, as the Alethi didn't have proper procedures for anything.
Then how do you apply for social reassignment?
We don't, Kaladin frowned.
Is this really that big a problem to you, Sig? Maybe, sir, it's not this specifically. Right now there are four religions represented in Bridge 4.
Four?
Hubber follows the passions, sir. Four, even if you don't count Teft, who I can't figure out rightly. And now there's all this talk of Bright Lord Dalinar claiming the Almighty is dead, and... Well, I feel responsible, sir.
For Dalinar? Kaladin frowned.
No, no.
He took a deep breath. There had to be a way to explain this. What would his master do?
And now,
Sigsel said, scrambling at an idea.
Everybody knows that Mishim, the third moon, is the most clever and wily of the moons.
All right. And this is relevant, why?
Because of a story, Sigsel said. Hush! Please listen, sir. You see, there are three moons, and the third moon is the cleverest. And she doesn't want to be in the sky, sir. She wants to escape. So one night, she tricked the queen of the Natan people. This was a long time ago, so they were still around. I mean, they're still around now, but they were more around then, sir. And the moon tricked her. And then they traded places until they stopped. And now the Natan people have blue skin. Does that make sense?
Kaladin blinked. I have no idea what you just said.
Well, Sigsel said, it's obviously fanciful. Not the real reason that the Natan people have blue skin, and,
it was supposed to explain something?
It's how my master always did things, Sigsel said, looking at his feet. He'd tell a story any time someone was confused, or when people were angry at him. And, well, it changed everything, somehow.
He looked to Kaladin. I suppose, Kaladin said slowly, that maybe you feel like a moon?
No, not really.
It was about responsibility, but he had really not explained it well. Storms. Master Hoyt had named him a full world singer, and here he couldn't even tell a story straight. Kaladin clapped him on the shoulder. It's all right, Sig.
Sir,
Sigsel said.
The other men don't have any direction. You've given them purpose, a reason to be good men. They are good men. But in some ways it was easy when we were slaves. What do we do if not all the men manifest the ability to draw in Stormlight? What is our place in the army? Bright Lord Kolin released us from guard duty as he said he wanted us practicing and training as Radiants instead. But what is a Knight Radiant?
We'll need to figure it out.
And if the men need guidance? If they need a moral center? Someone has to talk to them when they're doing something wrong. But the Ardents ignore us, since they associate us with the things Bright Lord Dalinar is saying and doing.
You think you can be the one to guide the men instead? Kaladin asked.
Someone should, sir.
Kaladin waved for Sigsel to follow him out into the corridor. Together they started walking toward the Bridge 4 barracks, Sigsel holding out a sphere for light. I don't mind if you want to be something like our unit's Ardent, Kaladin said. The men like you, Sig, and they put a lot of stock in what you have to say. But you should try to understand what they want out of life, and respect that, rather than projecting onto them what you think they should want out of life.
But, sir, some things are just wrong. You know what Teft has gotten into, and Huio. He's been visiting the prostitutes.
That's not forbidden. Storms, I've had some sergeants who suggested it as the key to a healthy mind in battle.
It's wrong, sir. It's imitating an oath without the commitment. Every major religion agrees to this except the Reshi, I suppose. But they're pagans even among pagans.
Your master teach you to be this judgmental? Sigzel stopped short.
I'm sorry, Sig, Kaladin said.
No, he said the same thing about me. All the time, sir.
I give you permission to sit down with Huio and explain your worries, Kaladin said. I won't forbid you from expressing your morals. I'd encourage it. Just don't present your beliefs as our code. Present them as yours, and make a good argument. Maybe the men will listen. Sigzel nodded, hurrying to catch up. To cover his embarrassment, more at completely failing to tell the right story than anything else, he dug into his notebook.
That does raise another issue, sir. Bridge 4 is down to 28 members after our losses during the first Everstorm. Might be time for some recruitment.
Recruitment? Kaladin said. He cocked his head.
Well, if we lose any more members,
we won't, Kaladin said. He always thought that.
Or, even if we don't, we're down from the 35 or 40 of a good bridge crew. Maybe we don't need to keep that number, but a good active unit should always be watching for people to recruit. What if someone else in the army has been displaying the right attitude to be a windrunner? Or, more pointedly, what if our men start swearing oaths and bonding their own spren? Would we dissolve Bridge 4 and let each man be their own Radiant?
The idea of dissolving Bridge 4 seemed to pain Kaladin almost as much as the idea of losing men in battle. They walked in silence for a short time. They weren't going to the Bridge 4 barracks after all. Kaladin had taken a turn deeper into the tower. They passed a water wagon, pulled by laborers to deliver water from the wells to the officers' quarters. Normally, that would be parshman work.
We should at least put out a call for recruitment, Kaladin finally said. Though honestly, I can't think of how I'll cull hopefuls down to a manageable number.
I'll try to come up with some strategies, sir, Sigzel said. If I might ask, where are we?
He trailed off as he saw Lynn hurrying down the hallway toward them. She carried a diamond chip in her palm for light and wore her Colin uniform, her dark Alethi hair pulled back in a tail. She drew up when she saw Kaladin, then saluted him smartly.
Just the man I was looking for.
Quartermaster Vevidar sends word that your unusual request has been fulfilled, sir. Excellent, Kaladin said, marching through the hallway past her. Sigzel shot her a look as she fell in with him, and she shrugged. She didn't know what the unusual request was, only that it had been fulfilled. Kaladin eyed Lynn as they walked.
You're the one who has been helping my men, right?
Lynn, was it? Yes, sir.
In fact, it seems you've been making excuses to run messages to Bridge 4.
Yes, sir.
Not afraid of the lost Radiance, then?
Frankly, sir, after what I saw on the battlefield, I'd rather be on your side than bet on the opposition.
Kaladin nodded, thoughtful as he walked. Lynn, he finally said, how would you like to join the Windrunners? The woman stopped in place, jaw dropping.
Sir?
She saluted.
Sir, I'd love that. Storms! Excellent, Kaladin said.
Sig, can you get her our ledgers and accounts?
Lynn's hand drooped from her brow.
Ledgers? Accounts?
The men will also need letters written to family members, Kaladin said. And we should probably write a history of Bridge 4. People will be curious, and a written account will save me from having to explain it all the time.
Oh, Lynn said. A scribe.
Of course, Kaladin said, turning back toward her in the hallway, frowning. You're a woman, aren't you?
I thought you were asking... I mean, in the High Prince's visions, there were women who were Knights Radiant, and with Brightness Shallan...
She blushed.
Sir, I didn't join the scouts because I liked sitting around staring at ledgers. If that's what you're offering, I'll have to pass.
Her shoulders fell, and she wouldn't meet Kaladin's eyes. Sigzel found, strangely, that he wanted to punch his captain. Not hard, mind you. Just a gentle wake-up punch. He couldn't remember feeling that way with Kaladin since the time the captain had woken him up that first morning back in Sadius's war camp.
I see, Kaladin said.
Well, we're going to have tryouts to join the order proper. I suppose I could extend you an invitation, if you'd like. Tryouts, she said. For real positions? Not just doing accounts? Storms, I'm in. Speak with your superior, then, Kaladin said. I haven't devised the proper test yet, and you'd need to pass it before you could be let in. Either way, you'd need clearance to change battalions. Yes, sir, she said, and bounded off. Kaladin watched her go, then grunted softly. Sigsel, without even thinking about it, mumbled, Did your master teach you to be that insensitive? Kaladin eyed him. I have a suggestion, sir, Sigsel continued. Try to understand what people want out of life and respect that, rather than projecting onto them what you think they should... Shut it, Sig. Yes, sir. Sorry, sir. They continued on their way, and Kaladin cleared his throat. You don't have to be so formal with me, you know. I know, sir. But you're a Light Eyes now, and a Shardbearer, and... Well, it feels right. Kaladin stiffened, but didn't contradict him. In truth, Sigsel had always felt awkward trying to treat Kaladin like any other bridgeman. Some of the others could do it, Teft and Rock, Lopin in his own strange way, but Sigsel felt more comfortable when the relationship was set out and clear, Captain and his clerk. Moash had been the closest to Kaladin, but he wasn't in Bridge Four any longer. Kaladin hadn't said what Moash had done, only that he had removed himself from our fellowship. Kaladin got stiff and unresponsive whenever Moash's name was mentioned. Anything else on that list of yours? Kaladin asked as they passed a guard patrol in the hallway. He received crisp salutes. Sigsel looked through his notebook. Accounts and the need for scribes, code of morals for the men, recruitment. Oh, we're still going to need to define our place in the army, now that we're no longer bodyguards. We're still bodyguards, Kaladin said. We just protect anyone who needs it. We have bigger problems in that storm. It had come again, a third time, this event proving that it was even more regular than the high storms, right around every 9 days. Up high as they were, its passing was only a curiosity. But throughout the world, each new arrival strained already beleaguered cities. I realize that, sir, Sigsel said. But we still have to worry about procedure. Here, let me ask this. Are we, as Knights Radiant, still an Alethi military organization? No, Kaladin said. This war is bigger than Alethkar. We're for all mankind. All right. Then what's our chain of command? Do we obey King Elokar? Are we still his subjects? And what don or non are we in society? You're a Shardbearer in Dalinar's court, aren't you? Who pays the wages of Bridge Four? What about the other bridge crews? If there is a squabble over Dalinar's lands in Alethkar, can he call you and Bridge Four up to fight for him, like a normal liege-vassal relationship? If not, then can we still expect him to pay us? Damnation. Kaladin breathed. I'm sorry, sir, it... No, they're good questions, Sig. I'm lucky to have you to ask them. He clasped Sigsel on the shoulder, stopping in the hallway just outside the quartermaster's offices. Sometimes I wonder if you're wasted in Bridge Four. You should have been a scholar. Well, that wind blew past me years ago, sir. He took a deep breath. I failed the exams for government training in Aesir. I wasn't good enough. Then the exams were stupid, Kaladin said, and Aesir lost out because they missed the chance to have you. Sigsel smiled. I'm glad they did. And, strangely, he felt it was true. A nameless weight he'd been carrying seemed to slide off his back. Honestly, I feel like Lin. I don't want to be huddled over a ledger when Bridge Four takes to the air. I want to be first into the sky. I think you'll have to fight Lopin for that distinction, Kaladin said with a chuckle. Come on. He strode into the quartermaster's office, where a group of waiting guardsmen immediately made space for him.
At the counter, a beefy soldier with rolled-up sleeves searched through boxes and crates, muttering to himself. A stout woman, presumably his wife, inspected requisition forms. She nudged the man and pointed at Kaladin.
"Finally," the quartermaster said. "I'm tired of having these here, drawing everyone's eyes and making me sweat like a spy with too many spren."
He shuffled over to a pair of large black sacks in the corner that, best that Sigsel could tell, weren't drawing any eyes at all. The quartermaster hefted them and glanced at the scribe, who double-checked a few forms, then nodded, presenting them for Kaladin to stamp with his captain's seal. Paperwork done, the quartermaster handed a sack to Kaladin and another to Sigsel. They clinked when moved and were surprisingly heavy. Sigsel undid the ties and glanced into his. A flood of green light, powerful as sunlight, shone out over him. Emeralds. The large type, not in spheres, probably cut from the gem hearts of chasm fiends hunted on the shattered plains. In a moment, Sigsel realized that the guards filling the room weren't here to get something from the quartermaster. They were here to protect this wealth.
"That's the Royal Emerald Reserve," the quartermaster said. "Held for emergency grain. Renewed with light in the storm this morning. How you talk the High Prince into letting you take it is beyond me."
"We're only borrowing them," Kaladin said. "We'll have them back before evening arrives. They'll be warned, some will be done. We'll need to check them out tomorrow again. And the day after that."
"I could buy a princedom for that much," the quartermaster said with a grunt. "What in Kalek's name do you need them for?"
Sigsel, however, had already guessed. He grinned like a fool. "We're going to practice being radiant." 36. Hero. 24 years ago. Dalinar cursed as smoke billowed out of the fireplace. He shoved his weight against the lever and managed to budge it, reopening the chimney flue. He coughed, backing up and waving smoke away from his face.
"We're going to need to see that replaced,"
Evie said from the sofa where she was doing needlework.
"Yeah,"
Dalinar said, thumping down to the floor before the fire.
"At least you got to it quickly. Today we will not need to scrub the walls, and the life will be as white as a sun at night."
Evie's native idioms didn't quite translate well into Alethi. The fire's heat was welcome, as Dalinar's clothing was still damp from the rains. He tried to ignore the ever-present sound of the weeping's rain outside, instead watching a pair of flame spren dance along one of the logs. These seemed vaguely human, with ever-shifting figures. He followed one with his eyes as it leaped toward the other. He heard Evie rise and thought she might be off to seek the privy again. She instead settled down next to him and took his arm, then sighed in contentment.
"It can't be comfortable," Dalinar said.
"And yet you are doing it?"
"I'm not the one who is..."
He looked at her belly, which had begun to round. Evie smiled.
"My condition does not make me so frail that I risk breaking by sitting on the floor, beloved."
She pulled his arm tighter.
"Look at them. They play so eagerly."
"It's like they're sparring," Dalinar said. "I can almost see the little blades in their hands."
"Must everything be fighting to you?"
He shrugged. She leaned her head on his arm.
"Can't you just enjoy it, Dalinar?"
"Enjoy what?"
"Your life. You went through so much to make this kingdom. Can't you be satisfied now that you've won?"
He stood up, pulling his arm from her grip, and crossed the chamber to pour himself a drink.
"Don't think I haven't noticed the way you act," Evie said, "perking up whenever the king speaks of the smallest conflict beyond our borders, having the scribes read to you of great battles, always talking about the next duel."
"I'm not to have that much longer," Dalinar grumbled, then took a sip of wine. "Gavilar says it's foolish to endanger myself. Says someone is bound to try to use one of those duels as a ploy against him. I'll have to get a champion."
He stared at his wine. He'd never had a high opinion of dueling. It was too fake, too sanitized. But at least it was something.
It's like you're dead, Evie said.
Dalinar looked over at her.
It's like you only live when you can fight, she continued. When you can kill. Like a blackness from old stories. You live only by taking lives from others.
With that pale hair and light golden skin, she was like a glowing gemstone. She was a sweet, loving woman who deserved better than the treatment he gave her. He forced himself to go back and sit down beside her.
I still think the Flamespren are playing, she said.
I've always wondered, Dalinar said. Are they made of fire themselves? It looks like they are. And yet what of emotion, Spren? Are anger Spren then made of anger?
Evie nodded absently.
And what of glory, Spren? Dalinar said. Made of glory? What is glory?
Could glory Spren appear around someone who is delusional, or perhaps very drunk, who only thinks they've accomplished something great, while everyone else is standing around mocking them?
A mystery, she said, sent by Shishi.
But don't you ever wonder?
To what end? Evie said. We will know eventually, when we return to the One. No use troubling our minds now about things we cannot understand.
Dalinar narrowed his eyes at the flame spren. That one did have a sword, a miniature shard blade.
This is why you brood so often, husband, Evie said. It isn't healthy to have a stone curdling in your stomach, still wet with moss.
What?
You must not think such strange thoughts. Who put such things into your mind anyway?
He shrugged, but thought of two nights before, staying up late and drinking wine beneath the rain canopy with Gavilar and Navani. She'd talked and talked about her research into Spren, and Gavilar had simply grunted while making notations in glyphs on a set of his maps. She'd spoken with such passion and excitement, and Gavilar had ignored her.
Enjoy the moment, Evie told him. Close your eyes and contemplate what the One has given you. Seek the peace of oblivion, and bask in the joy of your own sensation.
He closed his eyes, as she suggested, and tried to simply enjoy being here with her.
Can a man actually change, Evie? Like those Spren change?
We are all different aspects of the One.
Then can you change from one aspect to another?
Of course, Evie said. Is not your own doctrine about transformation? About a man being soul cast from crass to glorious?
I don't know if it's working.
Then petition the One, she said.
In prayer? Through the Ardents?
No, silly. Yourself.
In person? Dalinar asked. Like at a temple.
If you wish to meet the One in person, you must travel to the valley, she said. There you can speak with the One, or to his avatar and be granted
the old magic, Dalinar hissed, opening his eyes. A night watcher. Evie, don't say things like that.
Storms, her pagan heritage popped up at the strangest times. She could be talking good Boren doctrine, then out came something like that. Fortunately, she spoke of it no more. She closed her eyes and hummed softly. Finally, a knock came at the outer door to his rooms. Hathen, his room steward, would answer that. Indeed, Dalinar heard the man's voice outside, and that was followed by a light rap on the chamber door.
"It's your brother, Bright Lord," Hathen said through the door.
Dalinar leaped, opening the door and passing the short master servant. Evie followed, trailing along with one hand touching the wall, a habit of hers. They passed open windows that looked down upon a sodden Kolinar, flickering lanterns marking where people moved through the streets. Gavilar waited in the sitting room, dressed in one of those new suits with the stiff jacket and buttons up the sides of the chest. His dark hair curled to his shoulders and was matched by a fine beard. Dalinar hated beards. They got caught in your helm. He couldn't deny its effect on Gavilar, though. Looking at Gavilar in his finery, one didn't see a backwater thug, a barely civilized warlord who had crushed and conquered his way to the throne. No, this man was a king. Gavilar rapped a set of papers against the palm of his hand.
What?
Dalinar asked.
Rathalas, Gavilar said, shoving the papers toward Evie as she entered. Again?
Dalinar said. It had been years since he'd visited the Rift, that giant trench where he'd won his shard blade.
They're demanding your blade back, Gavilar said. They claim that Tanelon's heir has returned and deserves the shard as you never won it in a true contest.
Dalinar felt cold.
Now I know this to be patently false, Gavilar said, because when we fought at Rathalas all those years ago, you said you dealt with the heir. You did deal with the heir, did you not, Dalinar?
He remembered that day. He remembered darkening that doorway, the thrill pulsing inside him. He remembered a weeping child holding a shard blade, the father lying broken and dead behind, that soft voice pleading. The thrill had vanished in a moment.
He was a child, Gavilar,
Dalinar said, his voice hoarse.
Damnation, Gavilar said. He's a descendant of the old regime. That was... Storms, that was a decade ago. He's old enough to be a threat. The whole city is going into rebellion, the entire region. If we don't act, the whole Crownlands could break off.
Dalinar smiled. The emotion shocked him, and he quickly stifled the grin.
But surely, surely someone would need to go and rout the rebels?
He turned and caught sight of Evie. She was beaming at him, though he'd have expected her to be indignant at the idea of more wars. Instead, she stepped up to him and took his arm.
You spared the child.
He could barely lift the blade. I gave him to his mother and told her to hide him.
Oh, Dalinar.
She pulled him close. He felt a swelling of pride. Ridiculous, of course. He had endangered the kingdom. How would people react if they knew the Blackthorn himself had broken before a crisis of conscience? They'd laugh. In that moment, he didn't care, so long as he could be a hero to this woman.
Well, I suppose rebellion was to be expected, Gavilar said as he stared out the window. It's been years since the formal unification. People are going to start asserting their independence.
He raised his hand toward Dalinar, turning.
I know what you want, brother, but you'll have to forbear. I'm not sending an army, but I can nip this thing with politics. We can't have a show of force be our only method of maintaining unity, or Elokar will spend his entire life putting out fires after I'm gone. We need people to start thinking of Alethkar as a unified kingdom, not separate regions always looking for an advantage against one another.
Sounds good, Dalinar said. It wasn't going to happen, not without the sword to remind them. For once, however, he was fine not being the one to point that out.
37. The last time we march.
You mustn't worry yourself about race. It is a pity about Iona and Skye, but they were foolish, violating our pact from the very beginning.
Numuhuku Makiakia Ialunamor had always been taught that the first rule of warfare was to know your enemy. One might assume that such lessons weren't terribly relevant in his life anymore. Fortunately, making a good stew was a lot like going to war. Lunamor, called Rock by his friends, on account of their thick, lowlander tongues being incapable of proper speech, stirred his cauldron with an enormous wooden spoon the size of a longsword. A fire burned rockbud husks underneath, and a playful windspren whipped at the smoke, making it blow across him no matter where he stood. He had placed the cauldron on a plateau of the shattered plains, and, beautiful lights and fallen stars, he was surprised to discover that he had missed this place. Who would have thought he could become fond of this barren, windswept flatland? His homeland was a place of extremes, bitter ice, powdery snow, boiling heat, and blessed humidity. Down here, everything was so moderate, and the shattered plains were the worst of all. In Yakaved, he'd found vine-covered valleys. In Alethkar, they had fields of grain, rock buds spreading endlessly like the bubbles of a boiling cauldron. Then the shattered plains, endless empty plateaus with barely anything growing on them. Strangely, he loved them. Lunamore hummed softly as he stirred with two hands, churning the stew and keeping the bottom from burning. When the smoke wasn't in his face, this cursed too-thick wind had too much air to behave properly, he could smell the scent of the shattered plains. An open scent. The scent of a high sky and baking stones, but spiced by the hint of life in the chasms. Like a pinch of salt. Humid, alive with the odors of plants and rot intermingling. In those chasms, Lunamore had found himself again after a long time being lost. Renewed life, renewed purpose. And stew. Lunamore tasted his stew, using a fresh spoon, of course, as he wasn't a barbarian like some of these lowlander cooks. The longroots still had further to cook before he could add the meat. Real meat, from finger crabs he'd spent all night shelling. Couldn't cook that too long, or it got rubbery. The rest of Bridge Four stood arrayed on the plateau, listening to Kaladin. Lunamore had set up so that his back was toward Narok, the city at the center of the shattered plains. Nearby, one of the plateaus flashed as Renarin Kolin worked the Oath Gate. Lunamore tried not to be distracted by that. He wanted to look out westward, toward the old war camps. Not much longer now to wait, he thought. But don't dwell on that. The stew needs more crushed limb. I trained many of you in the chasms, Kaladin said. The men of Bridge Four had been augmented by some members of the other bridge crews and even a couple of soldiers that Dalinar had suggested for training. The group of five scout women was surprising, but who was Lunamore to judge? I could train people in the spear, Kaladin continued, because I myself had been trained in the spear. What we're attempting today is different. I barely understand how I learned to use Stormlight. We're going to have to stumble through this together.
It's all good, Goncho, Lopin called. How hard can it be to learn how to fly? Skyeels do it all the time, and they are ugly and stupid. Most bridgemen are only one of those things.
Kaladin stopped in line near Lopin. The captain seemed in good spirits today, for which Lunamore took credit. He had, after all, made Kaladin's breakfast. The first step will be to speak the ideal, Kaladin said. I suspect a few of you have already said it, but for the rest, if you wish to be a squire to the Windrunners, you will need to swear it. They began belting out the words. Everyone knew the right ones by now. Lunamore whispered the ideal.
Life before death, strength before weakness, journey before destination.
Kaladin handed Lopin a pouch full of gemstones. The real test and proof of your squireship will be learning to draw Stormlight into yourselves. A few of you have learned it already. Lopin started glowing immediately. And they will help the rest learn. Lopin, take first, second, and third squads. Sigzil, you've got fourth, fifth, and sixth. Pete, don't think I haven't seen you glowing. You take the other bridgemen. And Teft, you take the scouts and... Kaladin looked around. Where is Teft? He was only just noticing. Lunamore loved their captain, but he got distracted sometimes. Maybe air sickness.
Teft didn't come back to the barracks last night, sir, Layton called, looking uncomfortable.
Fine, I'll help the scouts. Lopin, Sigzil, Pete, talk your squads through how to draw in Stormlight. Before the day is done, I want everyone on this plateau glowing like they swallowed a lantern. They broke up, obviously eager. Translucent red streamers rose from the stone, whipping as if in the wind, one end connected to the ground. Anticipation sprang. Lunamore gave them the sign of respect, hand to his shoulder, then his forehead. These were lesser gods, but still holy. He could see their true shapes beyond the streamers, a faint shadow of a larger creature at the bottom. Lunamor handed off his stirring to Dabid. The young bridgeman didn't talk, and hadn't since Lunamor had helped Kaladin pull him from the battlefield. He could stir, though, and run water skins. He had become something of an unofficial mascot for the team, as he'd been the first bridgeman that Kaladin had saved. When bridgemen passed Dabid, they gave a subtle salute. Huio was on kitchen duty with Lunamor today, as was becoming more common. Huio requested it, and the others avoided it. The squat, beefy Herdazian man was humming softly to himself as he stirred the shiki, a brownish horn-eater drink that Lunamor had chilled overnight in metal bins on the plateau outside Urethiru. Strangely, Huio took a handful of lasbo from a pot and sprinkled it into the liquid.
"What are you doing, crazy man?"
Lunamor bellowed, stomping up.
"Lasbo? In drink? That thing is spicy powder, airsick lowlander!"
Huio said something in Herdazian.
"Bah," Lunamor said. "I do not speak this crazy language you use. Lopan, come here and talk to this cousin you have. He is ruining our drinks."
Lopan, however, was gesturing wildly at the sky and talking about how he'd stuck himself to the ceiling earlier. Lunamor grunted and looked back at Huio, who proffered a spoon dripping with liquid.
"Air sick fool," Lunamor said, taking a sip. "You will ruin—"
"Blessed gods of sea and stone, that was good." The spice added just the right kick to the chilled drink, combining flavors in a completely unexpected yet somehow complimentary way. Huio smiled.
"Bridge 4, he said in thickly accented Alethi.
"You are lucky man," Lunamor said, pointing. "I will not kill you today."
He took another sip, then gestured with the spoon.
"Go do this thing to other bins of shiki."
Now where was Haber? The lanky, gap-toothed man couldn't be too far away. That was one advantage of having an assistant chef who could not walk. He usually stayed where you put him.
"Watch me now, carefully," Lopan
said to his group, stormlight puffing from his mouth as he spoke.
"All right, here it is. I, the Lopan, will now fly. You may applaud as you feel is appropriate."
He jumped up and then crashed back to the plateau.
"Lopan," Kaladin called. "You're supposed to be helping the others, not showing off." "Sorry, Gon," Lopan said.
He quivered on the ground, his face pressed to the stone, and didn't rise.
Did you stick yourself to the ground?" Kaladin asked. "Just part of the plan, Gon," Lopan called back. "If I am to become a delicate cloud upon the sky, I must first convince the ground that I am not abandoning her. Like a worried lover, sure, she must be comforted and reassured that I will return following my dramatic and regal ascent to the sky."
"You're not a king, Lopan," Dreyi said. "We've been over this."
"Of course I am not. I am a former king. You are obviously one of the stupid ones I mentioned earlier."
Lunamor grunted in amusement and rounded his little cooking station toward Haber, who he now remembered was peeling tubers by the side of the plateau. Lunamor slowed. Why was Kaladin kneeling before Haber's stool, holding out a gemstone?
"Ah," Lunamor thought. "I had to breathe to draw it in," Kaladin explained softly. "I'd been doing it unconsciously for weeks, maybe months, before Teft explained the truth to me."
"Sir," Haber said, "I don't know if... I mean, sir, I'm no Radiant. I was never that good with the spear. I'm barely a passable cook."
Passable was a stretch. But he was earnest and helpful, so Lunamor was happy to have him. Besides, he needed a job he could do sitting. A month back, the assassin in white had swept through the king's palace at the war camps trying to kill Elokar, and the attack had left Haber with dead legs. Kaladin folded the gemstone in Haber's fingers.
Just try, the captain said softly. Being a Radiant isn't so much about your strength or skill, but about your heart. And yours is the best of all of us.
The captain seemed intimidating to many outsiders, a perpetual storm for an expression, an intensity that made men wilt when it turned on them. But there was also an astonishing tenderness to this man. Kaladin gripped Haber on the arm and almost seemed to be tearing up. Some days it seemed you couldn't break Kaladin's Stormblast with all the stones on Roshar. Then one of his men would get wounded, and you'd see him crack. Kaladin headed back toward the scouts he'd been helping, and Lunamore jogged to catch up. He bowed to the little god who rode on the bridge captain's shoulder, then asked,
You think Haber can do this thing, Kaladin?
I'm sure he can. I'm sure all of Bridge Four can. And perhaps some of these others.
Ha! Ah, Lunamore said. Finding a smile on your face, Kaladin Stormblessed, is like finding lost sphere in your soup. Surprising, yes, but very nice too. Come, I have drink you must try.
I need to get back to...
Come, drink you must try.
Lunamore guided him to the big pot of shiki and poured him a cup. Kaladin slurped it down.
Hey, that's pretty good, Rock.
Is not my recipe, Lunamore said. Huyo has changed this thing. I now have to either promote him or push him offside a plateau.
Promote him to what? Kaladin asked, getting himself another cup.
To Airsick Lowlander, Lunamore said. Second class.
You might be too fond of that term, Rock. Nearby, Lopin talked to the ground, against which he was still pressed.
Don't worry, dear one. The Lopin is vast enough to be possessed by many, many forces, both terrestrial and celestial. I must soar to the air, for if I were to remain only on the ground, surely my growing magnitude would cause the land to crack and break.
Lunamore looked to Kaladin.
I am fond of term, yes, but only because this thing has astounding number of applications among you.
Kaladin grinned, sipping his shiki and watching the men. Farther along the plateau, Drahi suddenly raised his long arms and called out,
Ha!
He was glowing with stormlight. Bissig soon followed. That should fix his hand. He too had been injured by the assassin in white.
This will work, Rock, Kaladin said. The men have been close to the power for months now, and once they have it, they'll be able to heal. I won't have to go into battle worrying which of you I'll lose.
Kaladin, Lunamore said softly, this thing we have begun, it is still war. Men will die.
Bridge Four will be protected by their power.
And the enemy? They will not have power?
He stepped closer.
Surely I do not wish to dampen Kaladin Stormblessed when he is optimistic, but nobody is ever perfectly safe. This is sad truth, my friend.
Maybe, Kaladin admitted. He got a distant look on his face. Your people only let younger sons go to war, right?
Only Twana Lekina, fourth son and younger, can be wasted in war. First, second, and third sons are too valuable.
Fourth son and younger. So hardly ever.
Huh? You do not know the size of Horn-Eater families.
Still, it has to mean fewer men dying in battle.
Peaks are different place, Lunamore said,
smiling at Silfrenna as she rose off Kaladin's shoulder and started dancing on the nearby winds.
And not just because we have right amount of air for brains to work. To attack another peak is costly and difficult, requiring much preparation and time. We speak of this thing more than we do him.
Sounds nice.
You will visit with me someday, Lunamore said. You and all Bridge Four, as you are family now.
Ground, Lopin insisted. I will still love you. I'm not attracted to anyone the way I am to you. Whenever I leave, I'll come right back.
Kaladin glanced at Lunamore.
Perhaps, Lunamore noted, when that one is away from too much toxic air,
he will be less...
Lopin?
Though upon consideration, this thing would be sad.
Kaladin chuckled, handing Lunamore his cup. Then he leaned in. What happened to your brother, Rock?
My two brothers are well, so far as I know.
And the third brother? Kaladin said. The one who died, moving you from fourth to third and making you a cook instead of a soldier?
Don't deny it. Is sad story, Lunamore said. And today is not day for sad stories. Today is day for laughter, stew, flight, these things.
And hopefully something even grander. Kaladin patted him on the shoulder.
If you ever need to talk, I'm here. That is good to know. Though today, I believe someone else wishes to talk.
Lunamore nodded toward someone crossing a bridge onto their plateau. A figure in a stiff blue uniform, with a silver circlet on his head.
The king has been eager to speak with you. Ha! Huh? Asked us several times if we knew when you would return. As if we are appointment keepers for our glorious flying leader.
Yes, Kaladin said. He came to see me the other day. Kaladin braced himself visibly, setting his jaw, then walked to the king, who had just marched onto the plateau, trailed by a cluster of guards from Bridge 11. Lunamore positioned himself, working on the soup where he could listen, as he was curious.
Windrunner, Elokar said, nodding to Kaladin. It seems you are right. Your men have had their powers restored. How soon will they be ready?
They're in fighting shape already, Your Majesty. But to master their powers... Well, I can't say, honestly. Lunamore sipped his soup and didn't turn toward the king, but stirred and listened.
Have you given thought to my request? Elokar said. Will you fly me to Kolinar, so we can reclaim the city?
I'll do as my commander tells me.
No, Elokar said. I'm asking you personally. Will you come? Will you help me reclaim our homeland?
Yes, Kaladin said softly. Give me some time, a few weeks at least, to train my men. I prefer to bring a few Squire Windrunners with us, and if we're lucky, I might be able to leave a full Radiant behind to lead if something happens to me. But either way, yes, Elokar. I'll go with you to Alethkar.
Good. We have some time, as Uncle wishes to try contacting people in Kolinar using his visions. Perhaps 20 days? Can you train your squires in that time?
I'll have to, Your Majesty.
Lunamore glanced at the king, who folded his arms, watching the Windrunners, prospective and current. He seemed to have come not just to speak with Kaladin, but to watch the training. Kaladin walked back to the scouts, his god following in the air after him. So Lunamore brought the king something to drink. Then he hesitated beside the bridge that Elokar had crossed to reach this plateau. Their old bridge from the bridge runs had been repurposed for moving people around these plateaus closest to Narok. Permanent bridges were still being reconstructed. Lunamore patted the wood. They'd thought this lost, but a salvage party had discovered it wedged in a chasm a short distance away. Dalinar had agreed to have it hauled up at Teft's request. Considering what it had been through, the old bridge was in good shape. It was made of tough wood, Bridge 4 was. He looked beyond it and was unsettled by the sight of the next plateau over, or the rubble of it. A stump of a plateau, made of broken rock that extended only 20 feet or so from the chasm floor. Relaine said that had been an ordinary plateau before the meeting of Everstorm and Highstorm at the Battle of Narok. During that terrible cataclysm, when storms met, entire plateaus had been ripped up and shattered. Though the Everstorm had returned several times, the two storms had not again met over a populated area. Lunamore patted the old bridge, then shook his head, walking back toward his cooking station. They could have trained at Uathiru, perhaps, but none of the bridgemen had complained at coming here. The shattered plains were far better than the lonesome plain before the tower. This place was just as barren, but it was also theirs. They also hadn't questioned when Lunamore had decided to bring along his cauldrons and supplies to make lunch. It was inefficient, true, but a hot meal would make up for it, and beyond that, there was an unspoken rule. Though Lunamore, Dabbit, and Haber didn't participate in the training or sparring, they were still Bridge Four. They went where the others went. He had Huyo add the meat, with a strict charge to ask before changing any spices. Dabbit continued to stir placidly. He seemed content, though it was hard to tell with that one. Lunamore washed his hands in a pot, then got to work on the bread. Cooking was like warfare. You had to know your enemy, though his enemies in this contest were his friends. They came to each meal expecting greatness, and Lunamore fought to prove himself time and time again. He waged war with breads and soups, sating appetites and satisfying stomachs. As he worked, hands deep within the dough, he could hear his mother's humming, her careful instructions. Kaladin was wrong. Lunamore hadn't become a cook. He'd always been one, since he could toddle up the step stool to the counter and stick his fingers in the sticky dough. Yes, he'd once trained with a bow, but soldiers needed to eat, and Nuotoma guards each did several jobs, even guards with his particular heritage and blessings. He closed his eyes, kneading and humming his mother's song to a beat he could almost barely, just faintly hear. A short time later, he heard soft footsteps crossing the bridge behind. Prince Renarin stopped beside the cauldron, his duty of transferring people through the Oath Gate finished for now. On the plateau, more than a third of Bridge Four had figured out how to draw in Stormlight, but none of the newcomers had managed it, despite Kaladin's coaching. Renarin watched with flushed cheeks. He'd obviously run to get here once released from his other duty, but now he was hesitant. Elikar had set up to watch near some rocks, and Renarin stepped toward him as if sitting at the side and watching was his place too.
"Hey," Lunamore said. "Renarin!"
Renarin jumped. The boy wore his blue Bridge Four uniform, though his seemed somehow neater than the others.
"I could use some help with this bread," Lunamore said.
Renarin smiled immediately. All the youth ever wanted was to be treated like the rest of them. Well, that attitude benefited a man. Lunamore would have the High Prince himself kneading dough if he could get away with it. Dalinar seemed like he could use a good session of making bread. Renarin washed his hands, then sat on the ground across from Lunamore and followed his lead. Lunamore ripped off a piece of dough about as wide as his hand, flattened it, then slapped it against one of the large stones he'd put to warm by the fire. The dough stuck to the stone, where it would cook until one peeled it off. Lunamore didn't push Renarin to talk. Some people you wanted to press, draw them out. Others you wanted to let move at their own pace. Like the difference between a stew you brought to a boil and one you kept at a simmer.
"But where is his god?"
Lunamore could see all Spren. Prince Renarin had bonded one, except Lunamore had never been able to spot it. He bowed when Renarin wasn't looking, just in case, and made a sign of reverence to the hidden god.
"Bridge Four is doing well," Renarin finally said. "You'll have them all drinking Stormlight soon."
"Like Lysau," Lunamore said.
"Ha! But they have much time until they catch up to you.
Truth Watcher is good name. More people should watch truth instead of lies."
Renarin blushed.
I suppose it means I can't be in Bridge Four anymore, doesn't it?"
"Why not?"
"I'm a different order of Radiant," Renarin said,
eyes down as he formed a perfectly round piece of dough, then carefully set it onto a stone.
"You have power to heal."
"The surges of progression and illumination. I'm not sure how to make the second one work, though. Shallan has explained it 7 times, but I can't create even the smallest illusion. Something's wrong."
"Still, only healing for now? This thing will be very useful to Bridge Four."
"I can't be Bridge Four anymore."
"That is nonsense. Bridge Four is not Windrunners.
Then what is it?
It is us, Lunamore said. It is me. It is them. It is you.
He nodded toward David.
That one. He will never hold spear again. He will not fly, but he is Bridge Four. I am forbidden to fight, but I am Bridge Four. And you? You might have fancy title and different powers.
He leaned forward.
But I know Bridge Four. And you, Renarin Kholin, are Bridge Four.
Renarin smiled widely.
But Rock, don't you ever worry that you aren't the person everyone thinks you are?
Everyone thinks I am loud insufferable lout,
Lunamore said.
So to be something else would not be bad thing.
Renarin chuckled.
You think this about yourself?
Lunamore said.
Maybe,
Renarin said, making another perfectly round piece of dough.
I don't know what I am most days, Rock, but I seem to be the only one. Since I could walk, everyone was saying, look how bright he is, he should be an Ardent.
Lunamore grunted. Sometimes, even if you were loud and insufferable, you knew when not to say anything.
Everyone thinks it's so obvious. I have a mind for figures, don't I? Yes, join the Ardents. Of course, nobody says I'm much less of a man than my brother, and nobody points out that it sure would be nice for the succession if the sickly, strange younger brother were safely tucked away in a monastery.
When you say these things, you are almost not bitter,
Lunamore said.
Ah, much practice must have been required.
A lifetime.
Tell me,
Lunamore said,
why do you wish to be man who fights, Renarin Kholin?
Because it's what my father always wanted, Renarin said immediately. He may not realize it, but it's there, Rock.
Lunamore grunted.
Perhaps this is stupid reason, but it is reason, and I can respect that. But tell me, why do you not want to become Ardent or Storm Warden?
Because everyone assumes I will be,
Renarin said, slapping bread down on the heated stones.
If I go and do it, I'm giving in to what they all say.
He looked for something to fidget with, and Lunamore tossed him more dough.
I think, Lunamore said, your problem is different than you say. You claim you are not the person everyone thinks you are. Maybe you worry instead that you are that person.
A sickly weakling.
No, Lunamore said, leaning in. You can be you without this being bad thing. You can admit you act and think differently from your brother, but can learn not to see this as flaw. It is just Renarin Kholin.
Renarin started kneading the dough furiously.
Is good, Lunamore said, that you learn to fight. Men do well learning many different skills, but men also do well using what the gods have given them. In the peaks, a man may not have such choices. His privilege.
I suppose. Gliss says, well, it's complicated. I could talk to the Ardents, but I'm hesitant to do anything that would make me stand out from the other Bridgemen, Rock. I'm already the oddest one in this bunch.
Is that so?
Don't deny it, Rock. Lopin is, well, Lopin. And you're obviously, you. But I'm still the strange one. I've always been the strangest one.
Lunamore slapped dough onto a rock, then pointed toward where Verlaine, the Parshendi bridgeman they used to call Shen, sat on a rock near his squad, watching quietly as the others laughed at Eth, having accidentally stuck a stone to his hand. He wore war form and so was taller and stronger than he had been before, but the humans seemed to have completely forgotten that he was there.
Oh, Renarin said. I don't know if he counts.
This thing is what everyone always tells him, Lunamore said. Over and over again.
Renarin stared for a long time while Lunamore continued to make bread. Finally, Renarin stood up and dusted off his uniform, walked across the stone plateau, and settled down beside Verlaine. Renarin fidgeted and didn't say anything, but Verlaine seemed to appreciate the company anyway. Lunamore smiled, then finished the last of the bread. He rose and set up the shiki drink with a stack of wooden cups. He took another drink himself, then shook his head and glanced at Huyo, who was harvesting the bread. The Herdazian man was glowing faintly. Clearly, he'd already learned how to draw in stormlight. Air sick, Herdazian. Lunamore raised a hand, and Huyo tossed him a flatbread, which Lunamore bit. He chewed the warm bread, thoughtful.
More salt in the next batch.
The Herdazian just kept harvesting the bread.
You do think they need more salt, don't you?
Lunamore said. Huyo shrugged.
Add more salt to that batch that I've started mixing, Lunamore said. And do not look so self-satisfied. I may still throw you offside a plateau.
Huyo smiled and kept working. The men soon started coming over for something to drink. They grinned, thumped Lunamore on the back, told him he was a genius. But of course none remembered that he had tried serving them shiki once before. They had mostly left it in the cauldron, opting for beer instead. That day they hadn't been hot, sweaty, and frustrated. Know your enemy. Out here, with the right drink, he was a little god unto himself.
Ha! A god of cool drinks and friendly advice.
Any chef worth his spoons learned to talk because cooking was an art, and art was subjective. One man could love an ice sculpture while another thought it boring. It was the same with food and drink. It did not make the food broken or the person broken to not be liked. He chatted with Leighton, who was still shaken by their experience with the dark god below Uathiru. Powerful god that had been, and very vengeful. There were legends of such things in the peaks. Lunamore's great-great-great-grandfather had met with one while traveling the Third Divide. Excellent and important story, which Lunamore did not share today. He calmed Leighton, commiserated with him. The thick-bodied armorer was a fine man and could talk as loudly as Lunamore sometimes.
Ha! You could hear him two plateaus away, which Lunamore liked. What was the point of a little voice? Weren't voices for being heard?
Leighton went back to his practice, but others had their worries. Scar was the best spearman among them, particularly now that Moash had left, but was feeling self-conscious at not having drawn in Stormlight. Lunamore asked Scar to show him what he'd learned, and, after Scar's instruction, Lunamore actually managed to draw some in himself, to his delight and surprise. Scar left with a spring to his step. Another man would have felt worse, but Scar was a teacher at heart. The short man still hoped that Lunamore would someday choose to fight. He was the only one of the bridgemen who actively spoke out about Lunamore's pacifism. Once the men had been thoroughly watered, Lunamore found himself looking out across the plateaus for some sign of movement in the distance. Well, best to keep busy with the meal. The stew was perfect. He was pleased to have been able to get the crabs. So much of what everyone ate in the tower was of soul-cast grain or meat, neither of which was very appetizing. The flatbread had cooked up nicely, and he'd even been able to concoct a chutney last night. Now he just had to... Lunamore almost stumbled into his own cauldron as he saw what was assembling on the plateau to his left.
Gods. Strong gods, like Silfrenna.
Glowing a faint blue, they clustered around a tall Spren woman who had long hair streaming behind her. She had taken the shape of a person, human-sized, and wore an elegant gown. The others swirled about in the air, though their focus was obviously the practicing bridgemen and hopefuls.
Uma Amitokuma Mafaliki,
Lunamore started, hastily making the signs of respect. Then, to be sure, he got down on his knees and bowed. He had never seen so many in one place. Even his occasional meeting with an Afaliki in the peaks did not hit him as hard as this. What was the proper offering? He could not give only bows for such a sight as this, but bread and stew? Mafaliki would not want bread and stew.
You, a feminine voice said beside him, are so wonderfully respectful, it borders on being silly.
Lunamore turned to find Silfrenna sitting on the side of his cauldron in her small and girlish shape, legs crossed and hanging over the edge. He made the sign again.
They are your kin? Is this woman at their front your Nuatoma, Ali'i Kamura?
Kind of, maybe, sort of halfway, she said, cocking her head. I can barely remember a voice, her voice, Venderana, reprimanding me. I got in so much trouble for searching out Kaladin. Yet, here they are. They won't speak to me. I think they assume that if they do, they'd have to admit to me they were wrong.
She leaned forward, grinning.
And they absolutely hate being wrong.
Lunamore nodded solemnly.
You're not as brown as you were,
Silfrenna said.
Yes, my tan is fading, Lunamore said. Too much time indoors, Mafaliki.
Humans can change colors?
Some more than others, Lunamore said, holding up his hand. Some from other peaks are pale, like Shin, though my peak has always been more bronze.
You look like somebody washed you way too much, Silfrenna said. They took a scrub brush to you and rubbed your skin off, and that's why your hair is red, because you got so sore.
These are wise words, Lunamore said.
He wasn't sure why yet. He'd have to ponder them. He fished in his pocket for the spheres that he had on him, which weren't many. Still, he arranged each one in its own bowl and then approached the assemblage of Spren. There had to be 2 dozen or more of them. Kali Kalinda! The other bridgemen couldn't see the gods, of course. He wasn't sure what Huyo or Haber thought of him walking reverently across the plateau, then bowing himself and arranging the bowls with their spheres as offerings. When he looked up, the Ali'i Kamura, the most important god here, was studying him. She rested her hand over one of the bowls and drew out the stormlight. Then she left, turning into a streak of light and zipping away. The others remained, a mottled collection of clouds, ribbons, people, bunches of leaves, and other natural objects. They flittered overhead, watching the practicing men and women. Silfrenna crossed the air to stand beside Lunamore's head.
They are looking, Lunamore whispered. This thing is happening. Not just bridgemen, not just squires. Radiance, as Kaladin wishes.
We'll see, she said, then huffed softly before zipping away as a ribbon of light herself.
Lunamore left the bowls in case any of the others wished to partake of his offering. At his cook station, he stacked up the flatbread, intending to give the plates to Haber to hold and distribute. Only Haber didn't respond to his request. The lanky man sat on his little stool, leaning forward, his hand in a tight fist that glowed from the gemstone inside. The cups he'd been washing lay in an ignored stack beside him. Haber's mouth moved, whispering, and he stared at that glowing fist in the same way a man might stare at the tinder in his fire pit on a very cold night surrounded by snow. Desperation, determination, prayer.
Do it, Haber, Lunamore thought, stepping forward. Drink it in. Make it yours. Claim it.
Lunamore felt an energy to the air, a moment of focus. Several wind spren turned toward Haber, and for a heartbeat, Lunamore thought that everything else faded. Haber became one man alone in a darkened place, fists glowing. He stared unblinking at that sign of power, that sign of redemption. The light in Haber's fist went out.
Ha!
Lunamore shouted.
Ha!
Haber jumped in surprise. His jaw dropped and he stared at the now done gemstone. Then he held up his hand, gawking at the luminescent smoke that rose from it.
Guys!
He called.
Guys! Guys!
Lunamore stepped back as the bridgemen left their stations and came rushing over.
Give him your gemstones,
Kaladin called.
He's going to need a lot. Pile them up!
Bridgemen scrambled to give Haber their emeralds, and he drew in more and more stormlight. Then the light suddenly dampened.
I can feel them again, Haber cried. I can feel my toes!
He tentatively reached out for support. Dre under one arm, Pete under the other, Haber slipped off his stool and stood up. He grinned with a gap-toothed expression and almost fell over. His legs obviously weren't very strong. Dre and Pete righted him, but he forced them back to let him stand precariously on his own. The men of Bridge 4 waited only briefly before pressing in with cries of excitement. Joyspren swirled around the group like a sweeping gust of blue leaves. Amid them, Lopin shoved in close and made the Bridge 4 salute. It seemed to mean something special coming from him. Two arms. One of the first times Lopin had been able to make the salute. Haber saluted back, grinning like a boy who'd just hit his first center shot with the bow. Kaladin stepped up beside Lunamor, Silfrenna on his shoulder.
It will work, Rock. This will protect them.
Lunamor nodded, then by habit checked toward the west as he'd been doing all day. This time he spotted something. It looked like a plume of smoke. Kaladin flew to check it out. Lunamor, along with the rest of them, followed along on the ground, carrying their mobile bridge. Lunamor ran at the center front of the bridge. It smelled of memories. The wood, the stain used to seal it, the sounds of several dozen men grunting and breathing in enclosed spaces, the slapping of feet on plateau, mixed exhaustion and terror, an assault, arrows flying, men dying. Lunamor had known what might happen when he chose to come down from the peaks with Kefha. No Nuatoma from the peaks had ever yet won a shardblade or shardplate from the Alethi or Vedans they challenged. Still, Kefha had determined the cost was worth the risk. At worst, he had thought he would end up dead, and his family would become servants to a wealthy lowlander. They hadn't anticipated the cruelty of Toral Sadius, who had murdered Kefha without a proper duel, killed many of Lunamore's family who resisted, and seized his property. Lunamor roared, charging forward, and his skin started to glow with the power of the stormlight from his pouch and the spheres he had collected before leaving. He seemed to be carrying the bridge all on his own, towing the others. Scar called out a marching song, and Bridge 4 thundered the words. Bridge 4 had grown strong enough to carry the bridge long distances without difficulty, but this day put those previous runs to shame. They ran at a sprint the entire distance, vibrant with stormlight, Lunamor calling the commands as Kaladin or Teft had once done. When they reached a chasm, they practically tossed the bridge across. When they picked it up on the other side, it seemed light as a reed. It felt like they'd barely started going before they neared the source of the smoke, a beleaguered caravan crossing the plains. Lunamor threw his weight against the bridge's outer support rods, pushing it across the chasm, then he charged over. Others followed. Dabbit and Lopin unhooked shields and spears from the side of the bridge and tossed one to each bridgeman as they passed. They fell into squads, and the men who normally followed Teft fell in behind Lunamor, though he had, of course, refused the spear Lopin tried to toss him. Many of the caravan wagons had been transporting lumber from the forests outside the war camps, though some were piled high with furniture. Dalinar Kolin spoke of repopulating his war camp, but the two high princes who remained behind had been encroaching on the land, quietly, like eels. For now, it was best to scavenge what they could and bring it to Yuathiru. The caravan had been using Dalinar's large wheeled bridges to cross chasms. Lunamor passed one of these, lying on its side, broken. Three of the large lumber wagons near it had been set afire, making the air acrid with smoke. Kaladin floated overhead, holding his brilliant shard spear. Lunamor squinted through the smoke in the direction Kaladin was looking and made out figures streaking away through the sky.
"Voidbringer attack," Drahi muttered. "We should have guessed they'd start raiding our caravans."
Lunamor didn't care at the moment. He pushed his way through weary caravan guards and frightened merchants hiding under wagons. There were bodies everywhere. The Voidbringers had killed dozens. Lunamor searched through the mess, trembling. Was that red hair on a corpse? No, that was blood soaking a headscarf. And that other body wasn't human. It had marbled skin. A brilliant white arrow stuck from its back, fletched with goose feathers, an Unkalaki arrow. Lunamore looked to the right, where someone had piled up furniture in a heap almost like a fortification. A head poked up over the top, a stout woman with a round face and a deep red braid. She stood up tall and raised a bow toward Lunamore. Other faces peeked out from behind the furniture. Two youths, a boy and a girl, both around 16. Younger faces from there, 6 in total. Lunamore dashed toward them and found himself blubbering, tears streaming down his cheeks as he crawled up the outside of their improvised fortification. His family, at long last, had arrived at the shattered plains.